This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. In Woody Allen's 2011 movie Midnight in Paris, Gil, a young Hollywood screenwriter and aspiring novelist played by Owen Wilson, is transported back to the 1920s Paris. Every night, he meets his heroes, Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Juno Barnes, Gertrude Stein. He encounters a cast of artists like Picasso, Luis Buñuel, Salvador Dali, Man Ray. Soon his only source of happiness is to travel back to this period, which still today carries this aura of creativity, freedom, and sophisticated partying. But what was it really like for American writers to live in Paris in the 1920s? Why did they feel the need to flee the United States? What were they searching for in France's capital? And what can they teach us today about the deep connections between American and French culture? To help us navigate the Année Folle in Paris, we're excited to welcome Antoine Guibal. Antoine Guibal is assistant professor of French and chair of the Department of Languages and Cultures at École Polytechnique in Paris. He completed his PhD on Stendhal at the University of Virginia in 2017. His book Stendhal Biographe was published in 2020. His fields of research include French Romantic literature, biography, and autobiography. He is also very much interested in the American literature of the 1920s and 30s, particularly the works of expatriate writers living in Paris. In the fall of 2024, he taught a course entitled Writing the Expatriation, American Writers in Paris in the 1920s, in the French department at Columbia University. Antoine Guibal, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Good morning.
The course you recently taught at Columbia University focuses on American writers who lived during the Année Folle in exile in Paris in the 1920s, and among them, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Gertrude Stein. What are the main reasons that led these and other writers and artists to leave the United States during that time? What did they find in Paris that they couldn't find at home?
Well, there's many ways you can answer that question. I think you can answer it both in terms of what they were looking for or seeking in Paris that they couldn't get in the United States at the time. You could also think of it, you know, in terms of what they were running away from or leaving behind. And, you know, that includes things like Puritanism, Prohibition, which just started in 1920 in the U.S., which meant that, you know, you couldn't drink alcohol freely or legally. And a lot of the writers that we'll be talking about had some experience in the war. They either fought in the war or they were, for quite a few of them, ambulance drivers, either in Italy, which was the case for Ernest Hemingway. And so after the war, a lot of them decided to stay in France longer. The socioeconomic context was very favorable. The exchange rate, for instance, was extremely favorable. We're talking, you know, $1 at the time was worth 15 to 20, sometimes 25 francs at the time, meaning that with a very average income in the United States, you could be very well off in Paris, live sort of like the high life. And so, you know, that's sort of like the economic aspect of the question. But also, there was a whole culture, what we could call a bohemian culture in Paris, that dated back to the mid-19th century. And so what we call the bohemian crowd were people who were sort of like reacting against the materialistic culture of the industrialized world, and they came to Paris. There was a novel published in the late 1840s by Henri Murger called The Scenes of Bohemian Life, which inspired a lot of people to come. And so when we talk about, you know, the Lost Generation and all the writers of the 20s who came to Paris, they really assimilated with or like identified with that crowd of like starving poets and artists who came in the mid 19th century and throughout the rest of the 19th century. People like Gertrude Stein, the famous art collector who moved to Paris in the early 20th century with her brother, Leo, to buy paintings and to, you know, they started this major collection of paintings. They're the ones who pretty much put Picasso on the map. And so, and Gertrude Stein was a key figure in literary circles at the time, even though she wasn't really read until later. But she started experimenting in the field of literature. Oftentimes we talk about her cubist style of writing, which was influenced by Picasso. And she had a literary salon in which you could, you know, run into Picasso, Apollinaire, Georges Braque, Juan Gris, people from all over Europe. And so, you know, when you were a young writer, which was the case with Hemingway, and you showed up in Paris, it was good to have a sort of like letter of introduction. I think it's called a formula.
And you're mentioning, Gertrude Stein, and I want to come back to a quote from her where she says, "It's not so much what France gives to you; it's what it doesn't take away." So. Do you think that was actually just a quip, or, you know, to your point, is there something positive that France and that Paris in particular was offering to these writers? I mean, you were mentioning experimentation in terms of cultural life. Was that also something that was attractive to American writers?
Yes, and so Gertrude Stein develops this whole theory or idea, and especially in her essay, which was published much later in 1940, called Paris, France, this idea that modern writers need to have two countries, the country that they come from and the country that they live in. And she argued that in order to be creative artistically, you need to have these two countries. So the one where you're from, the one that made you, but the one that you can be productive in. If you think of James Joyce, for instance, James Joyce shared in a way the same type of opinion, because he lived in exile most of his life. He thought, you know, Ireland was paralyzed, was in a state of paralysis, both mental and artistically, that, you know, he couldn't do anything in Ireland. And it's the same goes with Stein. The United States at the time was not a place where she could be creative. And so she argues in that, in the same essay, Paris, France, she says, Paris was great for us, so, you know, we Americans, because it had everything we needed in terms of, like, you know, machines, electricity, it was modern, but these things didn't sort of like prevail. People, you know, still lived in a certain way that was not, it was not all about that. And by saying that, she meant that, you know, in the United States, it was all about machines, all about making money, all about technology. And so when you were caught up in all these things, you were not, you know, productive.
And that's really interesting. And that tension between the two countries that you mentioned,
right.
I wonder the degree to which it was reflected in the writings of these writers and novelists of the time. Because it seems to me that even though they were in Paris, they were still writing about the United States. And, you know, Fitzgerald and Hemingway, I mean, their novels, I guess in the case of Fitzgerald, many of his short stories were taking place in Paris, but his novels were mainly in the U.S. and the same with Hemingway. How do you explain this? Maybe France and Paris appeared more in their writings than what appears to be the case, but it's certainly the perception that it didn't.
Right. So I think living in France at the time allowed them to, you know, to have the distance, both, you know, geographical and also temporal distance that they needed to talk about their own country. And it's true that if you look at the list of publications for the year 1925, you find major novels like The Making of Americans by Gertrude Stein. And just the title just says so much about the importance of the theme of America for writers at the time. The Great Gatsby was published in 1925. You know, it's a well-known parable of the American dream. And if you look at other, Dreiser's American Tragedy and stuff like that, so just the word American is very present in the titles of the works at that time. Fitzgerald does talk about some of his, like you said, some of his short stories. Many of them take place in Paris. I'll take the example of a short story he published in 1929 called The Swimmers, because it sort of like embodies the some of the major questions at stake when it came to people living in this state of expatriation. In that short story, you have, you know, the main character who's a Virginian. So the narrator says that he was prouder to be a Virginian than to be an American. And he marries a French woman called Choupette. And the whole plot sheds some light on what France meant at the time for these writers or for Americans versus what the U.S. meant. In a nutshell, the U.S., according to the bad guy in the story, was all about money, was all about technology, was all about industry. And the main character is drawn to France precisely for reasons like tradition and a certain way of life.
Right. Gertrude Stein famously coined the expression the lost generation to describe this group of writers. Why was the lost generation lost? Were they affected by the aftermath of the First World War? Were they alienated from American society? Or did they feel a more general sense of restlessness and disillusionment?
Right. So I think it depends on who you talk to, if I may say. Stein's definition, first she borrowed the phrase, if you remember, in A Movable Feast, from the owner of a garage place who scolded his employees because he didn't take care of her car fast enough or well enough. And he said, you know, you vous êtes tous une génération perdue, you're all a lost generation. And Stein reused the expression, and she told it to young Hemingway in her conversation at her place. And she, by that she meant, because we get the in the discussion that follows, we get sort of like the three criteria that apply to this label. So by a lost generation, she meant that you young people who fought in the war, so that's the first criterion, you were messed up by the war, you drink all the time, and you don't have respect for anything. And it's funny to see how Hemingway sort of like questions her statement, saying, you know, did you ever see me drunk? Did I ever show disrespect towards you? And she ends the conversation by saying, you know, don't contradict me. You're all a lost generation. And on his way back home, he has all these thoughts, and he's thinking, well, to hell with all of the easy labels. You know, isn't every generation lost in a way?
What you mean is that Hemingway was actually trying to own also the term lost generation and make it, turn it into something that was positive?
No, because we tend to read the Sun Also Rises as a sort of like a book written in praise of the lost generation, but he used it in a very ironic way, you know, as an indictment to the attitude of these people. He never wrote to praise the lost generation, but really to condemn the actions, the attitudes of some of the main characters in the novel. And so the other thing I wanted to mention was, if you take Malcolm Cowley's definition, because he's really the first one to sort of like try to come up with a clear definition, and pretty early on, as early as 1934, when he publishes Exile's Return, he says the lost generation. He gives a whole, you know, list of reasons why it was lost. But to him, the process of being lost and uprooted, because the two are linked, started much earlier. And maybe I could very quickly read the passage where he says that. So he says, "Yet in spite of their opportunities and their achievements, the generation deserved for a long time the adjective that Gertrude Stein had applied to it. The reasons aren't hard to find. It was lost, first of all, because it was uprooted, schooled away, and almost wrenched away from its attachment to any region or tradition. It was lost because its training had prepared it for another world than existed after the war, and because the war prepared it only for travel and excitement. It was lost because it tried to live in exile. It was lost because it accepted no older guides to conduct, and because it had formed a false picture of society and the writers placed in it. The generation belonged to a period of transition from values already fixed to values that had to be created." So this idea that it was caught in between two worlds or two time periods. So, you know, it was, yes, stuck in a sort of like no man's land between the past and the future.
And the future and also that it had very little to do in building that future and building that transition. So in a way it was lost also because it wasn't a real transition between one world and another.
And it's important to keep in mind too that the label Lost Generation was not a label that writers at the time wanted to carry as a medal of honor. You know, it was something they dismissed. They didn't think of themselves as a lost generation.
Coming back to the idea of uprootedness, I'm interested in the sense in which this uprootedness was actually felt. Was it really felt as some kind of source of angst, or was it felt as a source of creativity?
No, I don't think it was a source of anxiety because when we talk about exile has this connotation of, you know, something imposed and something, you know, that you do for political reasons. But these people weren't forced to flee. If anything, they were looking for this type of, they wanted to have that kind of experience. Fitzgerald spent a total of 5+ years in France. So, you know, nobody sort of like forced him to do that. Stein spent some 30 years. Sylvia Beach, of whom we'll talk about too, spent most of her life. Natalie Barney. No, I think the anxiety came a bit later in the second half of the 1920s when, you know, they some of them came back. We tend to think that they came back because of the depression, because of the, you know, economic reasons. But a lot of them actually had spent, you know, just a short amount of time in France and came back. And readapting to American life was actually a source of anxiety because all of a sudden they realized that the party was over, that they had to have jobs and, you know, earn money. And that the freedom that they had in France was pretty much gone. It is fair to say that while they were in France, you know, it was a time of insouciance. They didn't have to worry too much about anything because, again, they could sort of like afford to live there. So, yeah, the anxiety I would say would come a bit later when they had to come back. And you, if you think of it, you know, Fitzgerald went through a major depression in the 30s. He wrote this, you know, famous essay called The Crack Up, and some people like Hemingway, you know, very much blamed him for acknowledging or showing themselves so vulnerable. And you know, Hemingway, do you know how Hemingway, how his life ended? And we didn't mention that yet, but all these people were heavy alcoholics. So alcohol was very much a conversation. The war was still very much present when you walked around Paris at the time, even though we tend to think of that time as just a gigantic party. It was just a party for a tiny minority of people who could afford it, who hung out in these sort of like elitist circles.
And even Hemingway, I mean, in some ways, you sometimes have the feeling that he romanticized life in Paris. When he writes decades later, A Movable Feast, his memoir on his life in Paris, he talks about hunger, about eating simple meals, mentions hunger as a source of creativity, as you go hungry and you see an exhibition and all of a sudden you have revelations. I mean, there seems to have been some romanticizing also on the part of these writers.
Yes, very much so. He tends to romanticize his life in Paris, as you said, in A Movable Feast. So, you know, some 30 years later, when he writes The Sun Also Rises, there's nothing very romantic about Paris. Paris is mostly the place where you work. The main character in The Sun Also Rises has a strong discipline, work ethics, but he's surrounded by people who are very much lost in the sense of the lost generation because they drink all the time. They don't really work. They're well off to start with. They would, you know, a lot of them belong to what Fitzgerald called what was called at the time the leisure class, and people who could just afford to have a good time and, you know, go from one country to the other. And
they had a support network as well. So you mentioned, for example, Gertrude Stein, who was really playing the role of a salon organizer who was introducing people to each other. There's another center or meeting place for these writers, and that was Shakespeare and Company, the bookstore, which was owned by Sylvia Beach, who you mentioned earlier, who was the first to publish James Joyce's Ulysses. Can you talk a little bit about the role that Shakespeare and Company as a bookstore, as a place where you could go and borrow books as well, the role that it played for this community of writers?
Right. Sylvia Beach opened her bookstore, if I'm not mistaken, in 1919, so right after the war. And very quickly it became, there were English bookstores, bookshops in Paris, but her bookstore was specific in the sense that it was both a bookstore and a library, so you could, you know, check out books and bring them back. And she was also a major figure in the sense that first of all, it's one of those rare places where both American and just more generally English speaking writers could would meet and would come. But she would also attract a lot of French writers, people like Paul Valéry, for instance, would show up, Valéry Larbeau, all kinds of poets. Also, she had this role of sort of like her bookshop was in a way a salon, in the sense that you could mingle with people from different backgrounds with different languages. And I think it's due to her personality that she and you see that in her letters, but also in the testimony that Hemingway gives in A Movable Feast some 30 years later, very much paying homage to this woman. Not only did she have a key role in, as you said, in literature in general, because she did publish James Joyce's Ulysses, but also she very much cared for the young people who showed up at her place. So Hemingway talks about how he showed up one day and, you know, he was pretty much a nobody at the time, and asked if he could, you know, check out some books, and he didn't have a subscription or a card, or like he couldn't pay right away, and she said, you know, just don't worry, just take as many as you like and bring them back. So she trusted people, and that went a long way too. And when you read her letters, you feel like she's caring for all these people around her. It was not just business, or it was not just professional. She would inquire about, you know, James Joyce's eye surgery, and she would, you know, she had these personal relationships with all the writers that came to her place, and with her partner Adrienne Monnier, who had another bookshop across the street. They played, after the publication of Ulysses, a major role in the organization of, you know, the translation of Ulysses into French, which a lot of people took part in it, quite a few. It wasn't just one translator. It was several translators in French. And you had to, it was also almost a diplomatic exercise to content everyone. And also Joyce had his word to say. So,
I mean, the way you describe this community of writers around Shakespeare and Co., the way in which the salon that was held by Gertrude Stein seemed to work is they were gathering a number of exile writers, either from the United States, the UK, Ireland, other parts of the world. Was there a real deep intermingling with French writers and French intellectuals at the time? Were there, for example, friendships that developed between Fitzgerald, Hemingway? You mentioned Paul Valéry visiting the bookshop, but were there deep friendships among French intellectuals with this group of exile writers?
There were a few friendships, but surprisingly, what surprised me when I, while preparing my course at Columbia, it was that I was surprised by the lack of not so much interaction, but like influence. It's hard to say, for instance, because earlier you asked me what did these people, why did they come to Paris? It wasn't so much because, you know, a major French writer was there. even though Fitzgerald, for instance, very much admired someone like Anatole France, and there's a story of how when they came, I think in 1923, 1924, I forget, as soon as they got off the boat, Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald went to knock on the door of Anatole France's place, waited for an hour, he never showed up. But so they did have some admiration for some of the French writers, but not necessarily for the contemporary writers. It's hard to talk of a real influence. Hemingway, when he pays homage to French writers, goes way back. Like, he talks about Maupassant, he talks about Stendhal to some extent. Hemingway was very much influenced by painters, by Cézanne. For, you know, he said that, you know, Cézanne taught me how to write, you know, a true sentence. And as you said, you know, when I was hungry, I would go to the museum, and I had this whole new perception of Cézanne.
You mentioned also the influence, for example, that surrealist painters would have had on Gertrude Stein's poetry. How deep was the influence of the surrealist movement and other, you know, artistic movements at the time?
So the surrealists, I think because of the very nature of their approach, that is, it relied a lot on dreams and chance, was very much antithetic to Hemingway's method, for instance, which was, you know, to write the truest sentence you could think of. You know, Hemingway spent, and Fitzgerald too, for that matter, or Stein, they spent huge amounts of time proofreading, you know, their works and editing them, adding things, removing things. The Surrealist project was more about, you know, automatic writing based on, you know, also visions from dreams. The only friendships that I can think of, one is recounted by Malcolm Cowley in Exile's Return. So he's a poet, editor, writer, a critic. I first knew of him because he was much later a Kerouac's editor. And so, but he happened to be part of that first or like second wave of writers who came to Paris in the early 20s. And he only stayed for a couple of years. He attended classes at the Sorbonne. He was very much, he was very well read and knew very well the French canon, all the French writers. But he befriended, for instance, Aragon. He was very good friends with him. But he has some pretty harsh comments about just Dada and surrealism as a whole. And he says, you know, these guys, Aragon, Breton, Soupeau, Paul Éluard, they were the most talented writers of their generation. But in the end, you know, their project was a dead end. It's you know, it sort of like all went to waste. They didn't produce any work of art that's worth remembering. It's sort of unfair to say, but I think it says a lot about the perception that I think many Americans would have had about these writers at the time. That is, you know, yes, it's great experimentation. It leads to, you know, new approaches, etc. But did it really leave any major piece of literature? Not so much. And just keep in mind that all the surrealists would meet at the famous café, La Closerie des Lilas, which was sort of like the place, you know, in Montparnasse, with other places like the Dome, the Rotunda, the Select, where all the writers of the last generation would meet. So I'm sure that they, you know, they crossed paths several times. But in terms of like friendships and influence, it'd be a stretch to say that, you know, surrealists had a real influence on American writing, because I think the two projects were so different. And last thing, the barrier of the language. I mean, Fitzgerald just knew enough French to order food in restaurants and, you know, to go to hotels and stuff like that. I think in terms of the language, it would have been hard for people like Hemingway to really have stuff to say to the surrealists.
And what would you say about the way in which these writers are read today in France? I mean, you are, of course, teaching at École Polytechnique, one of the grandes écoles in Paris. How well read are your students about American writers of this period? And how deep do you feel is the interest more broadly in French society, in French literary circles today, for American literature produced in Paris during that time?
In class, when I talk about Hemingway, most of the students have read something some time ago by Hemingway, whether it be, you know, A Movable Feast or Farewell to Arms or maybe The Sun Also Rises or The Old Man and the Sea, obviously a classic. There was, I don't know if you remember, after the terrorist attacks in November of 2015, some people in Paris were interviewed on the street, and this old woman said, you know, oh, Paris is great, we need to, you know, go out and make love, etc., and read A Movable Feast. And all of a sudden, this book became very popular again. I think it was pretty popular as it was, but all of a sudden, everybody started to read that book again, and there were actually reprintings of the book and that kind of thing. So I think students today or people in France today, when they talk about the 1920s, they only see the sort of like the glitters, the frenzy, the parties, the booze, the cocktails. I mean, any new edition of The Great Gatsby has at least one of these elements, which I think misses the point in a way, because it's not so much about that than about, you know, the failure of the American dream. But I think, yeah, people know some of the most famous pieces by these authors, but nobody reads really Gertrude Stein anymore. I don't think so. Especially her early books, which are, you know, to most readers, extremely hard to get into. And, you know, Ulysses too, for that matter, by James Joyce. It's quite a challenge. So you have to sort of like prepare yourself psychologically, mentally. And it also requires quite a bit of time. So I think, you know, books like A Movable Feast are much more digestible, and people can much more relate to these types of books. Same for Gatsby. But I think a lot of the other productions of the time have sort of like been not forgotten, but at least, you know, put aside.
Right. Right. Well, thank you very much, Antoine. This has been really inspiring, and you've given us a real taste for that period, and a real desire also to go and visit the places that these authors haunted during the 1920s in Paris. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emmanuel.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris 1 Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.